From KQED Public Radio, this is the Capital Notes Podcast for Friday, June 18th. Hit it. Now, the question is, does that sound like a housefly?
Yes.
Or does that sound like...
A vuvuzela.
A vuvuzela.
Vuvuzela. Yes. Vuvuzela.
That's Anthony York, the editor of Capital Weekly and apparently World Cup fan.
Yes.
Is that an app on your iPhone that does
It's a free vuvuzela app.
Is it? Are you going to do that through the entire podcast? And so, like, when
only if provoked.
So
only if you score a goal.
So if I... Or if I let one dribble into the the net.
We'll take it. Take it.
Okay. So aside from the World Cup, there's California politics.
It's there. It's there.
Is there anything?
No.
I'm John Myers from KQED. I had to intro myself now at this point. After I got all thrown off by the
vuvuzela.
Vuvuzela. You know, what was it last year we liked saying all the time? Oh, Huda.
Huda.
Huda, which was the budget idea of a tax thing that we don't need to talk about. Now it's vuvuzela. Okay, so moving on to all the things we should talk about. Some happenings on the state budget this week and some things in the race for governor and some things about the November ballot and ballot measures. So
exciting.
Why don't we start with the budget?
Okay.
Speaking of putting people probably to sleep.
Speaking of little annoying noises, there's a lot of chatter about the budget.
Which will be a louder annoying noise as the summer goes on. But this week, of course, was the deadline, the constitutional deadline that is never met for a budget to be in place or the legislature to enact a budget or to send it to the governor, I should say, June 15th, which was approved by a ballot measure by voters 40 years ago, and they've never met it.
I say arrest them.
Yeah, like
arrest them all.
I think it's 26 out of the last 30 years it hasn't been met. But hey, who's counting? Me.
Yeah.
So no budget yet. Discussion still going on. Budget conference committee still meeting. I mean, definitely there's a difference in the process this way, is there not? That because everyone has said they want to negotiate the budget as much in public as possible. I mean, do you think that's different in some ways, that we're going to have more of these discussions as they get into revenues and
perhaps, although things? I think, the conference report that is scheduled to be adopted probably early next week is still going to leave a lot of the biggest ticket items open, will not deal with the revenue issue, will not deal with the question of at what level we fund Proposition 98, which determines the education funding, which is about half the budget.
In which case, right.
So it's like, we're done. Here's a third of a cheesecake.
Well, the fact that the fiscal year starts in 2 weeks, of course, as we know, always means everybody starts to kind of do this sense of what happens when we don't have it on July 1st. So we got the I almost hate to call it this, but almost the standard letter at this point from the state controller John Chung this week to the governor and the legislative leadership saying, here's what I can't pay in the absence of a budget on July 1st. And they're basically payments to schools and some local government payments and things like that. And then also saying, if you don't get a budget in place by August 1st, I'm going to have to defer even more of that. And then, of course, we get into an issue about the state having enough cash.
But not till the fall.
Not till the fall issue. Completely. Yeah, but and I was going to say the unfortunate part is that this becomes, for some people it may not be as noteworthy because we lived through it last year and we issued IOUs last year. So everybody kind of feels like been there, done that.
But that's an important thing to take away from that letter is that this year the state has a couple of months or a few months to go before it would have to issue IOUs. Now, whether that's a good or a bad thing, the legislature is a deadline driven entity. And if, a lack of an on time budget, that level of urgency isn't there if there are no threat of IOUs. Now, they will say that these deferred payments will hurt a lot of the institutions they care about. And so I think there will be an effort to try to get something done on time. But some have taken that controller's letter to be a bad sign in terms of hopes for getting out of here early.
And I think we probably should mention, too, that given that the discussions about the budget are still going, you've got – it depends on whether you define these as fully cooked plans, but you've got, three different kinds of worldviews out there right now. You've got the governor's worldview, which was his revised May budget, which has got lots of deep cuts to programs. You've got the Democrats in the state Senate worldview. It's not a fully cooked plan, but a worldview that says let's raise taxes in some places.
Right.
And then you've got the Assembly Democrats plan, which is borrowing money in some ways, though they would say it's not borrowing money.
Of course it is.
Of course it is. All right. Here's what I'm going to call it, though. It's a cash advance.
Yeah.
And you can decide whether a cash advance is borrowing or not. But it's a cash advance through this process called a securitization.
And they're borrowing against 20 years of new, yes, of new oil tax revenues.
Yeah. And I was just looking for a term just to kind of bring it home, as though you were looking for an advance of money you were due to get later. But that last one, the assembly plan, we had a little bit of clamor about here towards the end of the week. On Tuesday, on the date of the deadline on the 15th, the governor said he thought it was illegal, this whole notion of, if you've missed this part, effectively what they want to do is they want a cash advance, borrow, whatever, why do I care? They want to get money from Wall Street investors, paid back over 20 years through this complicated scheme of the beverage container recycling fund and an oil severance tax and all of these moves about sales taxes, but effectively paying that money back over time.
Yep.
And the governor said he thought it was illegal. And then here on Thursday of this week, the governor's office releases a letter from the attorney general's office that says, we too think that it could be illegal. And I want to say could, because the attorney general's letter is not definitive that they think it would be illegal, but that it could have problems with the constitutional ban on deficit borrowing approved by voters in 2004, Proposition 58.
And you thought it had no teeth.
I thought, what, Prop 58 had
yes.
no teeth?
Yes.
Yeah, well, you know, Prop 58 is just one of those strange things. It says that you've got to have a balanced budget. Great. And it says you can't borrow for a deficit. But it doesn't really define – and this is the problem. It doesn't define borrowing.
Right.
And it also doesn't make clear, too, are you're playing the soccer. That would be when we move to topic two.
Okay. That'll be our transition.
Exactly right. The horn is going off, apparently telling me that my time is up. But it doesn't – so anyway, it doesn't define borrowing. It also leaves open this thing about whether the borrowing is in response to a deficit or it's in response to something else, and on and on and on and on. But I think bottom line, it shows that when you get into a alternative like that, you are asking for a court challenge.
Right. Well, and that could potentially be a problem. Pardon my vuvuzela there. It's taking
a mind yes. of its own. Go ahead.
Yes. But what's sort of interesting about this to me, I mean, just from a political angle, is this is Jerry Brown wading into the middle of this budget battle.
By extension of his office.
I mean, he
wasn't the one who wrote the letter, but still.
But yeah. still, he's his name's on the letterhead.
He's the boss.
So, but it is a question. I think, look, this scheme that the Democrats have cooked up, where you create an oil severance tax and then borrow 20 years worth of those revenues. I think the bigger issue is that they take all 20 years of those revenues, an estimated, what is it, $9 billion, nine point something billion, and use it all to just plug the holes in this year's deficit, in this year's budget, without making any cuts. Now that it's a bargaining position, what I'm trying to gauge from folks is whether, you know, if they spent the revenues differently, or if it wasn't quite so big, or if they agreed to, you know, spread this money out over 5 years to form some sort of reserve or long-term plan, and this came along with cuts, could a mechanism like this be part of a final budget solution? And I get kind of a lukewarm maybe.
And it was also pointed out too that this securitization, this cash advance, I'm going to keep calling it, all the money in it wouldn't go toward the budget deficit. Some of the money is earmarked for these job proposals and all these other things.
Right.
No, but the point being is that, so if you were going to split out parts of what was legal or not legal, and could you do something else, but that still doesn't solve your budget problem. Even if you were to split some of that out, you'd have to find an alternative to solve the deficit.
Well, it all goes into – all this money goes into a new jobs fund, right? Because jobs is the key to the speaker's budget plan.
Well, it's the key to everything this year, though. The candidates are talking about it. Everybody's talking about it.
But you drill down a level, and it's just a new level of rhetoric placed on top of the same old stuff. You're talking about repayments to local governments, repayments to schools, funding schools at a higher level. And, you know, through this new lens that you know, everybody is viewing everything now, jobs, they're viewing these – it's a rhetorical I don't want to say game or gimmick, but it's a rhetorical change more than it is a policy change in terms of what this money would be used for. So, you know, what last year we were calling payments to education or payments to local government, now we're calling job creation. So go figure.
You know, and you mentioned the race for governor briefly because there's the intersection of Jerry Brown as the attorney general and everything. But even beyond that, it actually reminded me of something that Brown said last week after the primary election in his post-primary press conference in L.A. that I dragged myself to that morning. He said the governor's budget plans, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, so forgive me here, but I think I'd have the tape to back myself up. The governor's budget plan is full of holes. The Senate Democrats, the Senate plan is full of holes. The assembly plan has got problems. I think he didn't use full of holes because I was actually waiting for him to say it. But you got the sense that it wouldn't take much for the Democratic nominee for governor to start saying, I don't like the Democratic legislative plans for the budget, or they have problems, which does present a political issue there about, you know, whether that allows other people, you know,
but in terms
of anybody else.
But at the same time this week, we see again, I mean, Brown has sort of has this rhetorical quip that he uses time and time again on the stump that he's got a plan, but he's not going to talk about it during the election. He's got a secret plan to end the war in Vietnam, right? I mean, it's and the Whitman campaign hit him on it this week for not talking about specifics and not putting out a 48-page brochure, yeah. I guess, like the Whitman campaign did. But you know, at some point, I think Brown is going to be pushed on specifics for his ideas for closing the budget gap. And we'll see. I mean, he has said in the past, look, you're not going to solve it in 1 year. And you're not going to raise taxes, that means you're going to borrow.
Yeah, he actually said borrowing, in my conversation with him, yeah.
And I think if you listen to what the Department of Finance is saying and what the legislative analyst is saying, they're saying the same thing. So that we're not going to solve this hole and this structural deficit in 1 year, and we're not going to raise revenues exclusively, and so that means we're going to borrow. Yeah. So the question is,
however you define borrowing.
Right, or we're going to get a cash advance, as the case may be.
The other thing that happened budgetary wise this week, and it goes beyond the budget too, because it goes to, you know, really to the core, one of the core things of what Arnold Schwarzenegger is spending his time on in these last few months in office, was we had an agreement with four of the labor unions that represent state workers. And they only represent about 23,000 state workers, so that's
10%.
It's about 10% of the universe of workers, but even less than that of the unionized state workers, right. I think, which is under that number. But anyway, but they were highway patrol, firefighters, mental health techs, social workers, right. A list there of different people. But they were four contract agreements that have a budgetary impact, but they have a huge impact too, at least maybe just rhetorically, on this issue of pension reform, which the governor is spending a lot of time talking about. And the unions made concessions on the issue of pensions. They have to – their members will have to contribute more of their paychecks annually toward their pension, 10%, which is an increase from where they are now. Future hires – will have to work longer on the job for their full pension benefits. Mm-hmm. And they also will not be able to get as high a pension benefit from, say, a final year of work that's a higher salary.
They won't be able to do the spiking.
The spiking, as it's called, the upward trend of where your last year on the job was such a higher salary that it sets the level, the bar higher.
It'll now be a three-year average. Right.
And there's some modifications there depending on the groups. Like, for instance, there was also a provision that they'd take an unpaid day off every month that would save money. That basically was a pay cut, but the highway patrol's not doing that, and the firefighters aren't doing that.
Right.
So that really was a smaller universe.
Right.
But these are – I guess my point is that these are a bit of a template, I think, for the other unions that have to decide if they want them. You know, the two big ones that are sitting out there are SEIU, who represent a whole lot of state workers, and the prison guards, the CCPOA, who actually I think probably don't want to even come to an agreement with this governor, may wait for the next one.
I think that's right. But I do think – I mean, a couple of things and a couple of reasons why this is – big news this week. Number one is that question that you raise is about how these other unions, you know, is this a template now for other unions to make deals? Remember, the Highway Patrol was the only bargaining unit that had an existing contract. The rest of the state employees did not have a contract. So the Highway Patrol has a history of dealing with this administration in the past. So just because they cut a deal doesn't mean that other unions will. But I think that this has ramifications beyond that in a couple of ways. Number one is the governor's race. I think the Meg Whitman campaign in the early days of the general election campaign now, we're seeing that this is a campaign that's really predicated on demonizing public employee unions to a large degree. Those are the folks who are backing Jerry Brown's campaign. Whitman has called for reductions in the state workforce and called for pension reform. And it's predicated on this idea of kind of the greedy state employee who isn't making sacrifices. Well, if these bargaining units now cut deals and they're willing to take their fair share of the pain, I think that eliminates a huge issue for Whitman. I mean, I think one of the winners of if there are pension deals and more of them, I think Jerry Brown is a big beneficiary of that.
Assuming, though, that the Whitman campaign would not then say, well, these deals aren't real pension reform.
Well,
because one of the questions that is already percolating up, but just barely, but percolating a little bit, is whether or not the governor has actually agreed to things that are quote unquote real reform that will help fix the systemic problems with public employee pensions.
Well, raising the retirement age and reducing the contribution, and those are two pretty substantial reforms. I mean,
the hard part is that we don't know what the value of those are in the long term. The administration doesn't have the actuarial numbers yet.
Right.
They did say, and this is why I linked it back to the budget, they do think it would save about $72 million in the budget year that begins. And it could, if all the unions, this is their argument, they say, if all the unions would agree to this template, that it could save the state $2 billion, about $1 billion of that in the general fund,
right,
if in fact it all happened in this budget year.
And but that would be a combination of reduced pay and then reduced state pension contributions.
But let's also say, too, one of the reasons I think some of these unions came to the table is the unions got some concessions. It depends on whether you think these were worth what they gave up on pensions. But they got guaranteed no furloughs for 3 years.
Right.
That extends beyond the Arnold Schwarzenegger time in office to whoever's governor next. No furloughs for 3 years, and no threat of getting minimum wage if a budget's not in place.
Which is a big deal.
Yeah, because if you're not following this, there has been this ongoing debate over the last several years. It dates back even in the Davis administration, and we think the courts may resolve this sometime this summer. The Schwarzenegger people want it resolved, I think, as to whether or not the state is obligated to or has the power to pay state workers their full salary if the budget is not enacted on time. And it has not happened yet. They've always been paid their full salary. The only people who don't get paid are legislative employees, which is a very small subset of people. But if, in fact, the main state workforce was throttled down to minimum wage, you know, what is that, seven?
The federal minimum wage is federal minimum
wage. Actually, it would be federal, not state, which is higher.
Right.
So it would be even worse. But if you had that, I mean, you would have a tremendous impact all across the state on the economy and workers and families. And so that's going to keep playing its way out in the courts. There are countless state workers who I keep hearing about, I'm sure you do too, who are nervous watching the Schwarzenegger administration pushing this court case, thinking that's where the governor wants to go.
Well, and their
in the absence of a budget.
Unions have warned them that this regression to a federal minimum wage is a real possibility.
And so now you have 23,000 state workers who, assuming this all gets ratified in time, and there's still more to go. The deals were struck, but there's a ratification process. But now you have 23,000 state workers who say, not me.
Right.
And that becomes an interesting dynamic in the state workforce.
The other issue, just sort of taking a 35,000-foot view of this, is suddenly if you look at these deals, and especially if there are more that follow, look at this idea of a Schwarzenegger legacy, right? If he gets pension reforms, if he gets redistricting reform, the open primaries,
AB 32,
suddenly you've got some substance there for a real legacy and
infrastructure that he wants to talk
about. The infrastructure bonds as well. And I think that that is very much on the minds of the administration. And I think that you can make a pretty good case that, you know, at the end of his 7 years here, if these pension deals do sort of if more of them follow, especially that he does have a real record of making some pretty significant changes in state politics.
Of course, the reality is that legacies are not written immediately after somebody leaves office. They're written several years later.
Right.
And that's where I come back to something like the pension proposals.
We'll see.
Yeah, exactly. We may see 4 to 6 years later, hey, they really did save money, or they were window dressing, in which case that legacy would, but that's just the
way politics works. I remember famously the last time the prison guards had a deal, it was with the Davis administration, and the union lobbyist described it as giving up a dime in exchange for three nickels, right? So, we'll see once we get some more details on what these proposals are, and once the press vets them and they get some legislative vetting, we'll see what's actually contained in them, and if they are indeed a template for future deals going forward.
Do we vet things in the press?
We try. I read the Cliff's Notes.
All right. Let's talk about the governor's race, in which case, come on, Anthony.
The Vuvuzela is unavailable.
Oh,
sorry.
It's killing me here. I thought that was our little transition sound.
All right. We'll play the Vuvuzela.
Okay.
It's like the call to prayer, isn't it?
I don't know. It's worrisome.
Yes.
We've talked about the governor's race a little bit already in the dynamic of the budget. I'd say beyond that, we've had a lot of skirmishing that I don't think is really much other than skirmishing. The campaigns want to make it about more than it is, or the people who care about it, or the interest groups, you know, maybe who are aligned out there want you to think about some of it. I'm not convinced that any of it's really a big deal. So the things you heard a lot about this past week, breathlessly talked about, were Jerry Brown's reference to the Nazi propaganda minister, and maybe that had a reference to Meg Whitman, or that he was making a reference to her. Oh, goodness gracious. And then
Meg's a shubber.
And then Meg Whitman and a settlement out of court with a former employee at eBay.
Allegedly.
Not an alleged settlement.
Well, the details of the settlement weren't discussed, right?
But the allegations, the alleged fact that she might have shoved the person, or they had some kind of, who knows. All of this just feels like noise to me.
That's
the place for the Vuvuzela. We don't need him this time. But it feels like a bunch of noise. I mean, you know, the Brown one, just for a moment, which apparently happened in a conversation with a veteran reporter in the Bay Area, Doug Sovereign, and he wrote about it on his blog.
After a vigorous run, Brown pointed out.
Yes, exactly. After a vigorous run, which now Brown says was off the record, and it was some sweaty person he was talking to. I mean, he really tried to find some
sweaty
way to...
Sweaty men in spandex does not a press conference make.
He looks like to me he's trying to find some way to kind of belittle the messenger there, which I know Doug, he's a good guy. I don't think that's the right point. But I think the broader point is that, you know, and I want to be very careful and respectful here, too, because I do think it is very dangerous to start using references to a time in world history that there is no way to use properly. I mean, I think that's a very fair point. At the same time, the Jerry Brown stream of consciousness way of talking, people who have covered him are very familiar with. But I do think this does raise the question about the way Brown communicates.
Right.
A politician who grew up in an era that is long gone in American politics and media, how he communicates in this soundbite truncated blogosphere 24/7 world.
Right. Well, and this was a question too, remember, with John McCain and the Straight Talk Express in 2000, back when sort of blogs were just kind of coming online, if you will, that McCain had this kind of rolling press conference on his bus. And you know, I don't know that you would see something like that again, just because, you know, every little rhetorical misstep that you make gets amplified, you know, greatly. So, and Brown is he's a bit of a babbler, free associator. You know, he likes to think out loud. He appears to enjoy hearing himself think out loud. But now he's vowed, mum's the word. He's taken his vow of silence for the campaign trail. I mean, we'll see how long it holds. But it's, you know, It's 70, 71, 72 years in the making. I don't know if you're going to be able to turn that spigot off all at once.
And the reason that I thought, too, that the story just didn't hold is that he'd actually had said he had not used the name Goebbels and had not used that reference to controlling information or that. But he had made the point.
He did.
Well, no, but I was going to – he did in that.
Oh,
I'm saying. But he had made basically the same point about, you know, this control of the flow of information in the Whitman campaign in a different public comment before. And so his broader point about, you know, his criticism of the way he thinks they're controlling the whole flow of information in California by the money was lost because he happened to use the reference of information flow through Nazi Germany. And again, I'm not defending him using that, but that is where I think that the story fell apart for it being a quote-unquote story, because that wasn't even the point he was trying to make. He used the wrong reference, absolutely, and he knows it. Of course, I don't think he did a good job explaining it all these days afterwards.
Yeah.
But it just, you know, it didn't appeal to me. And in the same way, the Whitman story, really quickly, because that story, and I don't know the reporter who put it out. I want to be very, you know, I want to deferential to the New York Times, which is where the story ran initially. But that felt like an opposition research dump. There, I mean, that's an it was an old legal battle. No one, if you read the story specifically, no one saw the
very well.
No one actually saw the confrontation, the alleged confrontation between Meg Whitman and the employee. So this whole notion that Meg Whitman allegedly shoved the employee, no one saw it.
Right.
If you actually read the story specifically, there was just this, you know, sense that something had happened and the employee was angry or upset or whatever. And so, again, I want to take both of those and just set them aside and, you know, let's figure out what else is going on, like what's wrong with California and not Nazi Germany
and shoving.
Alleged shoving and lawsuit settlements or whatever they are.
Okay, no Nazis, no shoving. Moving on.
Yeah, moving on to our third topic. I know I don't tell you in time to get the iPhone.
We can't just vuvuzela on command here. We're not as young as we used to be.
All right, well, topic three.
There we go.
We might have to use this now on until people...
Until the World Cup is over.
Until people who listen to the podcast tell us they hate it.
That won't take long.
So our third topic quickly is the November ballot, which you wrote about, but you and I were both talking to people about this week.
Yes.
So only you wrote about it. So only you really did it.
You tweeted about it, though, didn't you?
Did I tweet about it?
I don't know.
But the point is we're watching what has the potential, as we're sitting here on a Thursday afternoon into Friday of this week, what has the potential to be a very big story in politics next week, which is that a lot of these ballot measures, not all of them, a lot of the ballot measures that have an eye on November and want to be on the November ballot and intend to be on the November ballot may not make the November ballot.
Right.
Because the elections officials in all 58 counties are still doing their sampling of signatures to see if they're valid signatures. And I've heard from registrars that they may not make it, in which case some registrars don't even think any of the initiatives would make it. Now, that may be a big speculation, but they only have, by the Constitution, by the state Constitution, until next Thursday, the 24th, which is 131 days from the election. They have to have be qualified for the ballot by that date. And there's a lot of work to be done, and these are measures that everybody's watching.
The majority vote
on the budget.
Repeal of AB 32.
Repeal or modification.
Suspension.
Of it or, yeah, exactly. It the repeal of the tax credits that
right.
That were in the budget deal.
Making it harder to raise legislative fees.
Yeah. And we had one widely watched measure that officially didn't make it for the November ballot this week, and that was the modification of term limits.
Right.
That's not going to
be on the November ballot.
So this is the kind of stuff, I mean, isn't it? I mean, where the voters would be thrilled to have four measures on the ballot instead of 12. But the political world will implode.
Yes. What will the consultorati?
There will be no money made by those campaigns.
No.
I mean, you and I talked about this before the podcast started. This is a factor of, there are a lot of different factors here. These campaigns got their measures in pretty late in the game. They submitted their signatures pretty late in the game.
Probably because it took them longer to get the signatures.
Well, there's a lot of discussion that it was tough to get signatures this spring, apparently, out there in some ways. There was a June primary election that local elections officials are still trying to tie the wraps up on that. Counties don't have lots of money to spend on overtime to check signatures. I mean, so, you know, elections offices might be strapped in some ways.
And also there have been some restrictions on petition gatherers at certain big box stores. Is it Costco that isn't allowing them anymore?
Actually, I didn't know that.
Yeah. One of them, I believe, has sort of cracked down on petition gatherers. And it could be that people aren't in the mood to sign these things this year. I mean, it could have to do with the specifics of what is being circulated, and that people aren't feeling it.
I wonder if one of the elements of this too, though, is several months ago, I think you were you referenced on the podcast first when we were talking about all the initiatives that had been introduced, that had been submitted to the state.
Right.
And there were, I mean, there were, I don't know if it was
dozens.
A record, but there were, I mean, no, I think there was close to like 80, weren't there at one point, that were floating around?
Dozens, right?
Dozens, yeah. I just like my number better. But there were a lot. There were a lot of them submitted. And I think you made the point that a lot of these were out there as part of a political chess game as to whether or right. not you were actually going to pull the trigger and put them on the street and gather signatures and try to get them on the ballot. And at least one conversation with a political source today with me came back to that theory that perhaps that chess game went on so long that a lot of folks made it to the street very late.
They didn't realize they were playing chess on the Titanic?
I don't know. Or they didn't realize that the clock had only 30 seconds on it instead of a minute, whatever analogy or metaphor we're making here. Anyway, but the point is that maybe a lot of those early positioning fights about if you put yours on the ballot, I'm going to put mine on the ballot, went on so long that then the people who actually did pull the trigger, they had a very short calendar to get all the signatures they needed. Because some of them are constitutional amendments, which is a higher threshold. Some are statutory, but even the ones that are statutory,
some of them may not
came in
it.
Late. Yeah.
Well, what's funny is that one of them that's circulating out there is a proposal to referend Proposition 11, the change in the redistricting law. Now, if it doesn't qualify in time for November, it'll still be on the ballot. It'll be on the next regularly scheduled statewide ballot, which would be in 2012. Well, the districts are going to be drawn in 2011.
Right.
So I mean, that one in particular, I mean, the term limits folks say, hey, look, the fact that we're going to have an election in 2012, that we're going to be on the 2012 ballot doesn't affect the implementation dates of our measure. But that's not the case for the redistricting measure. So, it would be interesting, though, if these things were on the ballot in 2012, if they would cause the legislature to act sooner, maybe try to preempt some of them.
Well, the two that stand out to me, actually more than two, the three that stand out to me that I think you could argue would be an impact if they didn't make it, and I want to be fair to the campaigns, there's no firm evidence that they're not going to make
the ballot
now.
They may.
Elections
they
officials
may
are in the process. They're working hard. Every elections person I've ever talked to in any county for any story, tries to do right. But in some cases, they're not obligated to be done by next week.
No.
They're just trying to get it done because they know everybody wants to know if it's going to be on the November ballot.
I think the only one that has to be done before the deadline is the local government measure.
But that was one of the ones I was going to mention. The local government one, which would forbid any borrowing in the future.
I think that one's going to qualify.
But I was going to say, if for some reason that one didn't make it, that has huge import, I think, though I don't think actually the state's under the ability to borrow from locals again for a few years. For a few years.
Right.
The tax credits one has big importance on the state budget because that could be, a few billion dollars by the time it got back on the ballot if you wanted to repeal those tax credits.
Right.
And the majority vote budget one because that clearly could change the dynamic about how hard it is to pass a budget in each house of the legislature.
Yeah.
So those have huge policy
and
ramifications.
And the fees
too.
As well. I mean, if it becomes harder to raise legislative fees, that's a big budgetary tool that is used often.
Well, I think it'll be interesting to see. Well, actually, we won't be able to talk about it on next week's podcast because I haven't made that announcement yet. But but it'll be interesting to see once we return to podcasting.
Oh,
what made it? What did not make it?
Hey, looks like we're all going to learn something here in just a minute.
No, didn't you want to have the buzzer again one more time?
I don't know.
Because now
we're
done. We'll do that when we're over. We'll do that when it's over.
Okay, but are we not podcasting?
We're not podcasting next week.
Oh, well,
because I'm on furlough.
Oh.
Yes. So a programming note to all you podcasters. Okay. I'm so sorry I brought it up. The buzz that never quits. No, there'll be no podcast next week because I'm on a mandatory station furlough, which is all part of our plan to save money and keep having jobs. And so we will be back the week after that, in which case we'll have all kinds of new things to talk about.
We can only hope.
So, Anthony, you are furloughed next week, too.
Hey, all right.
you and the
vuvuzela.
Vuvuzela.
Yeah.
I'll try to say that.
Hey, maybe I'll bring a vuvuzela in for our next podcast.
And oh, won't the audience look forward to that. And it's still going off over there. In which case, I'm going to let Anthony stop his iPhone. For Anthony York from Capital Weekly, I'm John Myers from KQED. We will see you in 2 weeks.